Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find A Cult of Personality Podcast at occultofpersonality.net and on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, and all the best podcast apps. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook to get the latest updates on new episodes and more. This episode features an interview with Robert Sullivan, author of Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs for me to bring it to you are significant. In order to ensure that the free A Cult of Personality podcast continues, I need your financial support now more than ever. If you're willing, consider supporting A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section or donating via the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. If you find these interviews interesting, informative, inspiring, and thought-provoking, please commit to helping me continue bringing you this podcast. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structured training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 167, our guest is Robert W. Sullivan IV, the author of Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. You can find his website at robertwsullivaniv.com. Sullivan appeared previously on the show in episode 146, to talk about his first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch. Robert W. Sullivan IV is a philosopher, historian, antiquarian, jurist, theologian, writer, and lawyer. Mr. Sullivan is a Master Mason and 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason. The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism was published in 2012 and is his first book. In 2014, Sullivan published his second book, the subject of our conversation this evening, Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies, which is about occult numerological, astrological, mythological, alchemical, tarot, and Kabbalistic iconography and symbolism contained within popular movies. Films analyzed in the book include The Exorcist, Back to the Future, Star Wars, The Lord of the Rings, The Wizard of Oz, Black Swan, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the James Bond movies, The Matrix, and many others. Robert Sullivan's Cinema Symbolism is a tour de force through modern film, exploring the esoteric symbolism encoded within. I appreciate the insight, expertise, and thorough nature of his analysis. The symbolic ideas explored by the book are serious subjects, but it's still very readable and enjoyable at the same time. I also appreciated the authority that Sullivan brings to the subject. Based only on his previous book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, Sullivan is not only highly qualified on the subject of esoteric symbolism, philosophy, religion, and history, but his personal experience with Freemasonry and cinema makes his writings on the subject far superior to all other analysis of popular entertainment that I've ever read. If you enjoy movies and want to know about the esoteric symbolism some of them convey, this is a must read. Brother Robert Sullivan, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's always good to speak with you.
Hi, Brother Greg. It's great to return. Pleasure to be here, of course. Second appearance. I'm very much looking forward to talking a little cinema symbolism, and thank you for having me on. It's much appreciated.
Before we talk about cinema symbolism, I just want to say, well, number one, I think, you know, most listeners remember you from your previous appearance discussing your book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, and now we're talking cinema symbolism. And before we get into it, you know, you've disclosed some lesser known information, shall we say, about the Masonic tradition and prior influential traditions to that. And now you're exposing the secrets of cinema, of film symbolism. And I'm just wondering, have you encountered any difficulties, resistance to your work, threats, any kind of, you know, anything of that sort?
No, not really. Most of the response, I'll be honest with you, most of the reaction has been positive. With the Masonic book, which is the first book, that has been pretty well received. I have lectured on it. I've been invited to Masonic lodges to speak on it. I was up actually in your neck of the woods about a little over a year and a half ago in Rhode Island, lecturing on the Royal Arch to an assembly of York Rite Masons, Masons from Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Actually, the Grand Master, I believe, of the state of Massachusetts was in attendance during the lecture as well. So no, the Royal Arch has been met with pretty well received. I have some pending invitations out west, which I'm currently looking into to speak to Masonic lodges in Denver, Colorado, and California, and also in Portland, Oregon. But that's pending right now. to be honest, there has been a few Masons who have not liked it. You know, this is to be expected. You know, I knew going into this there was never going to be unanimous liking across the board. But by and large, the reaction has been very positive. I was glad the reaction, by and large, was positive within Freemasonry with other Masons. But of course, there is always people who don't like it and don't like your work and have something negative to say. But this comes with the territory. And somewhat, at this point in time, to be completely honest with you, Brother Craig, I'm somewhat bulletproof to this at this point in time.
Well, that's good. The reason I asked the question is, listeners may recall Kentroversy, a blogger and podcaster who was met with an untimely end, shall we say. He was actually working on a book on this very same subject of cinema symbolism, you know, when he passed. So I know it's a subject that seems on the surface to be, you know, very, what would I say, you know, kind of vanilla, like it's not dangerous, but
it is, really.
Exactly.
who was the who was the podcaster? I don't know this one.
Kentroversy?
No, I've never heard of him. I'm sorry.
Daniel Benkowski, I think his website was kentroversypapers.blogspot.com, and yeah, that was about 2008, I think, that he passed away. But he was in the midst of actually working on a book about this subject, and he never finished it.
Yeah, no, I never heard of this person until you brought it up. But by and large, with the movie, with the cinema symbolism book, I mean, you're right. It's not innocuous. It's not innocuous at all. I mean, it's very deep waters, actually. But with cinema symbolism, I have not received any sort of death threats or anything like that. Nothing so far, at any rate.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm not trying to, you know, create any controversy where there is none, but just curious about it because, you know, maybe you could just talk a little bit about, you said, you know, the subject is kind of deep waters and maybe it doesn't seem so at first.
Yeah, absolutely. What got me started on all this, and I know we did a Royal Arch show, so I'm not going to belabor this point, but if you're familiar with the first book, the concluding chapter dealt with Masonic sort of solar Enochian symbolism in popular movies. One of the big tip-off movies to this was the first National Treasure movie, which this is in the Royal Arch book, which is essentially the retelling of this Royal Arch Masonic ritual. I mean, there it is on the big screen, you know, the discovery of the subterranean treasure vault of the Masons and the Templars beneath the holy ground. I mean, there it is. I mean, that's the ritual. That's the National Treasure movie. And this was always a subject that had fascinated me. I was familiar with Joseph Campbell and his influence upon Lucas with the monomyth and the Hero with a Thousand Faces book. I was seeing very heavy Gnostic overtones in movies like The Matrix. When I was doing Royal Arch, this was just something that really fascinated me. And when I got done Royal Arch, I really, quite literally, the minute that Royal Arch came out, I just started writing Cinema Symbolism 2. This would have probably have been early autumn of 2012, I want to say. And that came out, Cinema Symbolism was originally published, I want to say, in the summer of 2014. I'm actually writing its sequel right now, Cinema Symbolism 2. But it's deep water stuff. I mean, a lot of people, but the one thing I kind of, there were a couple motivating factors. I mean, for starters, the motivating factor was, I mean, I was seeing it. I mean, I was seeing it as plain as day. But the other thing was there was this sort of body of research that somewhat, you know, and I don't really like to disparage or put down or anything like that when I do these shows. I'm much more interested in talking about my own work. But every time this subject matter came up, it was this idea of every time you see an eye in a triangle in a movie or even something that resembles this, this is evidence of this, you know, overarching Masonic, Illuminati, occult, Luciferian agenda somehow or another. You know, I mean, what it is, no one knows, but there's the eye in the triangle. So this must be some sort of Masonic MK Ultra mind control program. I never bought into that. I still don't buy into that. What I was finding with these movies was, well, you know, just how adroit this material is concealed and conveyed both to your conscious and subconscious mind. I mean, you're really dealing with themes of Kabbalah, of astrology, of astrotheology, of archetypes. You know, we're dealing with the collective unconscious. We're dealing, you know, with archetypal imagery. We're dealing with numerology. We're dealing with comparative religion. We're actually, in some instances, dealing with comparative cinema, where actors, and this is something I'm finding out more and more, that actors and actresses maybe cast in a certain role for the cinematic baggage they bring to that role, creating some sort of like esoteric construct within the movie. So it's very deep waters. I mean, it goes much more in depth than just, oh, there's an eye in a triangle. This is MK Ultra Masonic Illuminati mind control. You know, I really wanted to get into the deeper arcana of this, the comparative religion, the ancient religion, Hebrew Kabbalah, Christian Kabbalah, numerology. This was the material that really fascinated alchemy. This was the stuff that really fascinated me. And it was really the 20 years of Royal Arch that I put into that. I essentially turned it on Hollywood. And out came Cinema Symbolism, and I'm actually writing its sequel right now, Cinema Symbolism 2.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. So you probably know better than I where to begin, but I'm curious. You mentioned this idea of casting actors for roles in movies to sort of have them bring along, like, maybe other ideas of other roles they played, or maybe like personal baggage in their own lives that sort of are like wrapped up in the idea of them on the screen. I think that's a fascinating concept, and I've only heard that discussed maybe in a few places, but I think that's really amazing idea.
Well, you want to talk about it? Let's talk about this then, if you don't mind.
You know, please.
No, this is something that I started doing with Cinema Symbolism. I found two examples that were really, really strong to me, but I'm finding this more and more. And it seems to be more commonplace than even I thought anticipated. What we're talking about is the idea of casting an actor or an actress for a certain part. Usually it's because of some other part that they've been in, and they bring that part with them subconsciously or consciously to the role. And it creates this sort of really kind of like esoteric, it's like a construct within a construct almost. It's like a role within a role in a movie, if that makes sense. The two that really, that I talked about in Cinema Symbolism, I'll give you some other ones, was in the first, this was a classic one. In the very first Star Wars movies, this was Episode 1, this was Phantom Menace. You have the Anakin Skywalker story. This is something I talk about in the book. Is this Christ allegory? You know, how Anakin is the chosen one. He's rejected by the temple elders. He wants to stop people from dying. He eventually storms the temple. It's you know, very Christ-like in nature. And one of the interesting things is Anakin Skywalker is actually virgin birth. His mother in it is played by an actress named Pernilla August. She plays Shmi Skywalker. This is Anakin's mother. And this is in Phantom Menace when Liam Neeson is talking to her. He says, "Who is his father?" And she said, "Well, there isn't one. You know, he just happened," indicating it was virgin birth. So you get this whole virgin birth motif going as well, and it's transforming Anakin into this Christ savior figure. What's interesting with this is Pernilla August, the woman who plays Anakin Skywalker's virgin mother, actually that very same year in 1999 in a TV movie, same actress played the Virgin Mary in a TV movie called Mary the Mother of Jesus. And you can't tell me she wasn't cast for this parallel role that she played in this movie, in this TV movie where she played the Virgin Mary. She's now cast as Anakin's virgin mother. And the baggage she's bringing is that it's you know, she's the virgin mother, and it's investing Anakin Skywalker with this Christ allegory, just like, you know, where she played the mother of Jesus. Another great one is Anthony Zerbe in the second Matrix movie. I can't remember the character's name, but he's cast as one of these elder statesmen in Zion, which is the last human holdout, sort of like one of the council members or something. There is a scene in that where he's talking to Neo about how Zion is the last bastion of mankind and how it needs to be preserved and how it's worth defending. And, you know, we've got to hold out. We can't let the dark machines in. This is actually a complete Gnostic what you would call dualistic reversal of a part that Anthony Zerbe played in the early 1970s in The Omega Man, where Anthony Zerbe delivers this exact same speech, only it's reversed. He plays this mutant leader, and he's talking about Charlton Heston's hideout and how Heston is the last bastion of mankind and how it needs to be eradicated and destroyed, and we got to get in there and kill this guy. He's the last holdout. So it is just so fascinating that they cast Zerbe as sort of now he's the preserver of mankind, and he's bringing this cinematic baggage with him from The Omega Man, where it's completely reversed, and where he was trying to annihilate the last bastion of mankind. I mean, I thought that was just absolutely fascinating. I'll give you one more, and this is something that's going in cinema symbolism, and I just discovered this one, and I was like, huh. And this is another great one. In Cinema Symbolism 2, I'm doing a whole section on the works of David Lynch, who is very into Gnosticism and ancient mysteries and ancient religions and symbolism. And I mean, his movies, by and large, are overloaded with this stuff. One of his more complex movies, and it's very difficult to dissect. I mean, it's difficult because you can interpret this thing so many different ways. There's a movie that came out in 1997. It's called Lost Highway. And in the movie, I'm not going to belabor this again too much longer, but in this movie, Bill Pullman and Robert Loggia play two, for lack of a better term, scumbags in this movie. Pullman's character is this sort of domineering control freak. He's very pessimistic. He's very gloomy. He wants to control the Patricia Arquette, all over the place. He's a control freak. Robert Loggia is the same way. He's this control freak. He's this gangster. He's a thug. He's a scumbag. He's just a real lowlife. Both of them are. And I'm watching this movie, and I'm thinking to myself, where have I seen these two guys before? And it was just it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was a few months earlier, in the summer of 1996. So we're only going back about 6 or 7 months on this one. Robert Loggia and Bill Pullman, during the summer of 1996, were saving planet Earth from these invading space aliens in a movie called Independence Day, where Pullman played the president and Loggia played this sort of hard-nosed general, where they're defending mankind. They're these, savior, very heroic figures defending mankind from these invading space aliens. So I think a few months later, by David Lynch, by turning these characters on their head and portraying Loggia and Pullman as scumbags, what Lynch is showing you is his utter contempt he has for the Hollywood blockbuster. And I thought that was another great one of these sort of esoteric casting calls by, with Lynch putting these guys in this movie as scumbags, basically saying to the world, hey, this is what I think of your Hollywood blockbuster.
Wow. Fascinating. This like collective memory of Hollywood and all kinds of personal things going on as well. It's fascinating. So you mentioned the Matrix movie and you spent some time in the Cinema Symbolism book talking about that, and I think that's one of my favorite series in terms of cinema symbolism. It seems overloaded with the Gnostic themes and the fake reality and...
Absolutely. I mean, I would say if you really want to see the Gnostic religion, Gnosticism proper, on the big screen, that's the movie to watch. It's really the first Matrix movie. I mean, you have the whole thing with the false reality. You have the demiurge. You have your the creator of the materialistic false reality. He turns up in part two as the architect. You have the agents of the demiurge, who are the agents. These are the enforcers of the demiurge. Of course, this is led by Agent Smith. Then you have Neo Anderson, Thomas Anderson, as the Christ-like solar savior, who's going to bring gnosis and awakening to mankind. And of course, he's in this mankind's in stasis. So Neo is going to, bring them out of this. It's a lot of, bringing to light. I like it. When he goes to meet Morpheus, very interesting dualistic name to give to this guy. In mythology, Morpheus is the god of sleep and dreams. Yet it's Morpheus who's going to bring Neo to the real world. They go into the hotel. They go up the ladder of ascension. They go up the staircase to meet with Morpheus. And he takes the pill, and then he becomes sort of the symbolic Alice in Wonderland. Goes through the looking glass you know, melds with the glass and wakes up in the real world. But I like it how he's lifted cruciform like Jesus towards the light into the belly of the Nebuchadnezzar. So it's this whole idea of being brought to light, being killed and resurrected, being brought back from the dead to life, you know, a Gnostic epiphany. And then, you know, Neo, again, is going to be the savior figure. I like the one little hint they give you when they bring Neo into the deck of the ship of the Nebuchadnezzar. You'll see the nameplate, and it says Mark 3:11. Mark 3:11 is just that, a very esoteric reference to the Bible verse, Mark 3:11, which I think I'm paraphrasing here, but says something to the effect of, "Thou art the Son of Man, and all darkness and demons bow down to you." I mean, and then you've got the whole idea of Sophia, the sacred feminine, the female wisdom provider, who is of course Trinity, and she helps, you know when he's in the Matrix, she helps resurrect him. I mean, and then at the end he heads off into the the Gnostic Pleroma, like Jesus ascending up into the heavens. So yeah, I mean, if you really, you know, I mean, did you really have in that movie too? What I liked with The Matrix is, you know, when you're talking about Gnosticism and you're talking about the godfathers of Gnosticism, sort of the two of the most famous fountainheads of Gnostic thought, of Nanni and Valentinius. I mean, there you have it. I mean, you have the Manichaean strain with the whole light versus dark, good versus evil, matter, you know, spiritualism versus materialism, you know, matter and nothingness, you know, conflict going on. And then you also have the Valentinian strain, which is the, you know, rejection of materialism for spiritualism, the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar who are seeking higher spiritual truths and willing to leave behind the decadence of the phony material world. I mean, I totally agree with you, Brother Greg, completely Gnostic. I mean, if you asked me to list the top three Gnostic movies of all time, the first Matrix movie would definitely be probably number one.
Yeah, I can't help but just be drawn in by that idea of the completely fake reality. Obviously, the Truman Show did that too, in a much different way. But yeah, the Matrix, that was a mind blower, I think, at the time. The time that I saw that, yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, you've got the whole thing with the fake reality. You had this in the Truman Show as well. I mean, in the Truman Show, it's this, you know, where you have the character of Ed Harris is your Manichaean demiurge, the creator of the phony material world. I liked in the Truman Show how you have sort of your archon is the wife in that, Laura Linney. I mean, you know, all her sole purpose is, I mean, she could care less about him. All she wants to do is hawk the material wares. I mean, everything's a commercial for her. I thought that was really clever. And then, I mean, the Truman Show kind of parallels the Matrix. I mean, the whole thing at the end, setting off in the ship for the new world. I mean, you know, you have, you know, at the end of the Matrix where Neo ascends into the heavens. I mean, you have Truman doing the same thing. You know, walking up into the clouds, you know, to the spiritual realm. So, two very Gnostic movies. The Matrix is great, though, because, I mean, you know, that is just one that is just so ripe with symbolism. And I just love the whole, the whole idea of, you know, the dead and resurrected savior figure. I love the name of the female Trinity. I mean, that's just so great. That comes straight out of the Gnostic world, the Nag Hammadi Library. You know, with the Holy Trinity, one of the components of the Holy Trinity was the sacred feminine, Sophia. So you have her name, you know, Trinity. I mean, you know, dead giveaway. Then you have him stuffing the money in the book on nihilism about how the real world is meaningless. I thought that was a great little tip off. I mean, and then even the guy says it to him, you're my own personal Jesus Christ. I mean, that tells you, I mean, if there isn't foreshadowing and anticipation, I don't know what is. So, no, the Matrix is a great one for Gnosticism, and so is The Truman Show. I mean, two very, very, very Gnostic movies.
Do you think it's worth commenting at all that the directors of the Matrix trilogy have now both transgendered?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't know what motivated that. When I was writing the first book, the one brother, I called them in the book the Wachowski brothers, and then it became the Wachowski siblings. The one became a transgendered, and then most recently, I think within the last 6 or 7 months, the other one became transgendered. Transgendered. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's motivating that. I don't have an explanation for it. It is odd, to say the least. Certainly, they have made other movies, that seem to be esoteric in nature, but I haven't seen them. I mean, I know they've made them. I haven't seen them, and I never comment on something I haven't seen. But they're probably like, you know, the Matrix trilogy for them is probably going to be what Star Wars is to Lucas. I mean, that's probably what they're going to be remembered for. I mean, I don't think, you know, if you say the name George Lucas, I think most people think of Star Wars. Not maybe a couple of people think of Howard the Duck, but I think most people think of Star Wars. I think when you say their names, I think most people are going to remember the Matrix movies.
Sure. You mentioned this idea of the goddess in film. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In cinema symbolism, I didn't want to leave the female out. I get into both sides of the female, the dark and the light. This is something I'm also carrying forward in cinema symbolism too. But in cinema symbolism too, I'm more concentrating on the darker side of things. But no, you definitely have the goddess. I mean, if you're going to have the solar hero figure, you know, the Frodo Baggins, the Luke Skywalkers, the Neo Andersons of the world. I mean, you certainly have the female savior as well. Granted, they're probably not as popular, but they're in there and they're worth talking about. I mean, I know sometimes Hollywood can get a bad rap on some of this, but I mean, you think of movies such as the Aliens films with Ellen Ripley, and what's great about this is the female usually can take the form. She can be a warrior. She can be the mother. She can be the lover. She turns up in different roles, in the philosopher. You have Ellen Ripley in the Alien movies, who's really sort of the warrior. You'll find her paralleled in this very esoteric movie called The Fifth Element by Luc Besson. That movie is overloaded with loads of hidden symbolism. And of course, you have she quite literally is Lilu. That the fifth element herself is the savior of mankind. So you have her there. You could find this archetype. I mean, Princess Leia in Star Wars, of course. Galadriel in Lord of the Rings. If you have the solar hero, Luke Skywalker. Then you have the female figure. The female savior, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, is another one of these, especially on the TV show. She's Sarah Michelle Gellar. I mean, there's a great female hero, female savior type figure. So no, when you get into the goddess, the sacred feminine, this could take many guises. But you can look at it negatively also. There are these negative female archetypes, and it really manifests in Hollywood as this evil mother figure. The mother in Hollywood, by and large, is, I don't know why this is, but the mother figure is always portrayed as some sort of, you know, monster almost.
Mommy Dearest.
You think of Mommy Dearest, you think of Norma Bates in Bates Motel, who's the voice of Norman. There's some other great ones out there. What's an Alien, the name of the evil computer, Mother. Is the name of the evil computer in the first Alien movie. Pamela Voorhees in the first Friday the 13th movie. It's always the mother is portrayed as some sort of, you know, demonic figure of some kind. I go through a whole laundry. The woman in Carrie, the mother in Carrie is a total nutjob, a basket case. The mother in the Dead Zone who's protecting the serial killer. It turns up over and over again. I'm not sure why that is. So yeah, I love talking about sort of the negative and the positive and negative aspects of this goddess female archetypal character that is very powerful in cinema.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you were talking about that, it really reminded me of the mother of Grendel in the Beowulf poem.
Yeah, that's another one. Absolutely correct. Yeah, I mean, it's always the mother is sort of presented as this sort of, evil entity. I don't know why this is. I mean, it's not every case, certainly. But, I remember when I was doing this, I was trying to think back of like two positive mother figures that I could think of. I mean, the only two that really jumped into my head for some dumb reason was Forrest Gump's mother, played by Sally Field. And then the Gwyneth Paltrow character in Seven, who winds up getting her, head cut off, for God's sake. So Yeah, I don't. I'm not sure why that is, but it's definitely an interesting paradigm.
Wow, that's really fascinating. You know, it's interesting to me that you're able to see the movies and these archetypes and myths. You're kind of, I'm assuming, just they're just jumping out at you. Is that right?
Well, it's one of those things, Craig. When if I go to, I think what you're kind of asking me is like my methodology in this.
Sure.
You know, it takes me. I'll put it to you like this. It takes me more than one viewing for me to do this. If I go to a movie theater and watch the movie, I just go for entertainment value. I may make some mental notes, but this cannot be done in a movie theater. I have to have the movie at my fingertips where I can pause it, move around, jump forward, backwards. If it takes me more than one viewing to pick up on this, and especially a lot of these movies, and especially some of the ones I'm finding out right now, are very multi-layered. It's a movie that I'm taking on at Cinema Symbolism too. I don't want to get into it too much, so I don't want to give a lot away. But there's a movie that came out last October called Crimson Peak that I just recently acquired, and that movie is very multi-layered. I mean, there is so much going on in that, multiple viewings for that one. So when I do this, I mean, it does jump off the screen. I don't necessarily consciously look for it. It's one of those things, it just starts coming to me, and I can just start picking up. I mean, it's sort of like just an odd synthesis that happens. But once I kind of pick up on it, it's funny how it sort of falls into place. Once I kind of get onto what this director's trying to tell me and what I'm dealing with, that's when the stuff really starts to jump off the screen. You know, am I dealing with comparative religion? Am I dealing with an alchemical movie? Am I dealing with a Gnostic movie? Am I dealing with, an archetype? Am I dealing with astrology, or numerology? Is there a number in a movie that's being beaten into my head over and over again? So that's part of the study in this, but it takes me definitely more than one viewing to do it, or to properly dissect the movie. And like I said, I'm constantly jumping around from, you know, beginning to end, fast forwarding, going back and watching and scenes and this and that. But once I figure it out, once I figure out what the director's trying to tell me, assuming anything, I mean, you know, not every movie has this stuff, then I know I'm on the right track.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you feel like you're kind of almost like in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, that you're kind of revealing things? They're obviously hidden in plain sight, but most people don't pick up on them.
Oh, I definitely think so. I definitely think that I'm revealing stuff that most people are not aware of. I think that was part of my motivation of writing probably both books. Mm-hmm. Was to reveal, was to kind of explain some of the stuff and reveal new things. I did not want either book and the book I'm writing to be a rehash or anything like that. I mean, I wanted these books to be fresh material. And certainly you have to have building blocks, and you have to, get into the world of, Joseph Campbell and get explanatory so people know what you're talking about. But I definitely, I mean, at least I think I tried, I hope I did, to reveal and present new information in both my books. I think I'm doing this also with Cinema Symbolism too. So, no, I do believe I am presenting new material. At least I hope I am.
Yeah, no, I definitely think you are. I'm just, I think it's interesting that, both you're revealing this new information, but it's also accessible to people, but most people don't have the eyes to see it the way you do. So it's really interesting to me, and I'm interested to hear the methods that you go through to do it. One of the things I was wondering also is how do I say this? The people making these films and putting all of this effort into the symbolism in the script and the set and the I assume this takes many different forms and whatnot, but do you imagine that the people doing this expect most viewers to sort of unravel the threads that they've sewn together, or is this something that they do more for their own amusement, or to kind of subconsciously affect the audience? I know we've talked about this before, but I'm always interested to hear your take on this thing.
I think it's a combination of any one of those. I think for some directors, I think of like a Darren Aronofsky. I think it's like a game of chess with him, that he does challenge you to try to pick up on little things. This is definitely the case of this new movie, Crimson Peak. This thing is just overloaded with stuff. And it tweaks your subconscious mind. But this goes back in time. Also, we could turn to the works of Stanley Kubrick. He does this in different movies. What I like about Kubrick is he uses occult techniques, but he doesn't use the same one over and over again. He uses something very specific in The Shining, which is repetition. And what he's doing with repetition in The Shining. I mean, that whole movie, the entire first Shining movie, they remade it in I think, 96. The Kubrick Shining is just a study of repetition. In fact, it's so repetitive, you could almost forget that you'd say that he almost forgot to tell a movie there. I mean, the repetition that goes on in this. I talk about Shining briefly in Cinema Symbolism. I have a whole section in Cinema Symbolism 2 about The Shining and all this repetition that he's doing. And what he's doing with this is consciously, you may pick up on a little bit, but he's really drilling into your subconscious head, your subconscious mind, this notion of this reincarnation, this vicious Ouroboros, this vicious reincarnation cycle that's going on inside the Overlook Hotel. But then what I like with Kubrick is he uses esoteric imagery in like Eyes Wide Shut, but it's not the repetition because there's no reincarnation, there's no vicious, you know, cycle going on, but he uses something else in Eyes Wide Shut. So I like this when the directors, you know, are in tune with what this esoteric theme is, and then they come up with something to convey it to your subconscious mind, but they do it separately in each movie. They don't do the same thing over and over again. It's different for each movie. Aronofsky does something very similar in Black Swan. There's a lot going on, but he only limits it to that movie. You won't find it in other movies because that movie is very specific about, you know, Tarot embodiment, Tarot archetypes. But Black Swan has a very beneath the surface alchemical storyline in it. And Aronofsky's aware of this. I mean, he has all the hallmarks of alchemy all over that thing. And this is something I break down in Cinema Symbolism too. So, you know, I think then you can get into the whole idea of, is this all a coincidence? I think it's all very intentional, but I do allow for the coincidence. I mean, I don't, you know, it's the old line, I'm, as a lawyer, there's no such thing as a coincidence. But I've certainly seen movies, and this is something that, you know, I briefly talked about with, like, you take a movie like Glenn or Glenda, the Ed Wood movie. Bela Lugosi, that's a great example of the Gnostic Demiurge. And Ed Wood had no clue about this. I mean, you know, Ed Wood wouldn't have known what a Gnostic Demiurge is to save his life. So, you know, then we get into the realm of the Carl Gustav Jung, the collective unconscious, the inherited archetypes, the inherited ancient religion. So you get into the idea of, well, you know, the directors also may be influenced by this, and they may be, you know, subconsciously doing this, and they may not even be aware of it. That to me is more of the exception than the rule. My belief is just because of how hardcore these guys put this stuff in and how pedantic they can be about it. I mean, and especially when you're dealing with things like, you know, the Matrix movie or, you know, The Shining or this Crimson Peak movie or Black Swan, or The Exorcist is another one. I mean, you know, you have all this little hidden symbolism all over the place. I mean, these guys are very, very well know what they're doing. I do believe it's intentionally placed. I think it's really a case of to me, the best way I can describe this, Greg, is it's really by incorporating all these ancient themes, this arcana, this, you know, these ancient archetypes, ancient religions, you know, it's really transforming celluloid into new mythology. That's really the best way for me to describe it.
I love that description. I agree. Yeah. You mentioned The Exorcist, and I want to talk about that movie because that movie, I think that was the first scary movie that I saw. And I think it's still one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. And the fact that I know the fate of the cast and people involved with the movie reinforces that impression.
Well, right. I mean, The Exorcist, it was probably, I think I'm probably in the same ballpark with you. The Exorcist was the first horror movie that I think I ever saw. I mean, it scared the living daylights out of me the first time I saw it. I saw it as a kid. I mean, I probably shouldn't have seen it. I mean, it literally just scared the hell out of me. And I agree with you 100%. I think the movie's timeless. I mean, I think the movie is as scary today as it is, as it was when it came out back in 73, 74. But I love the film. I mean, I think it's just a horror masterpiece. I mean, arguably the scariest movie of all time. And the director, Friedkin, I just love some of the esoteric archetypal imagery he places in that film. I mean, for example, I love at the very beginning of it where you have the one priest, the hermit priest, Father Marin, in the Holy Land, you know, sort of investigating the pagan roots, you know, of Christianity, the Christian priest investigating the pagan temple. One can't help but think of the Jesuit priest Athanasius Kircher, who did very similar things. And then he finds the Marin character finds the little talisman of the demon head. And then the clock stops, you know, your time is up. I mean, then he's hit with all these, heralds of woe, you know, the funeral carriage, the one eye, the guy with the evil eye, the guy with the one eye. And then he finally confronts the demon, the demon statue, up on the hillside. I mean, you see the two dogs fighting. I thought that was great imagery, but kind of obvious. But then I love it in the background, the setting sun, the death of the sun, the death of light. You know, your Neoplatonic Christ is dying. Darkness is being exalted. Hence, you know, the demons can come out to play when there's no light, you have darkness. Again, you know, we're dealing with ancient themes of Zoroastrianism and Manichaeanism. And then I love the one thing that he does that's so clever in this, and Kubrick does this years later in The Shining, a few years later, is I love the scene where Chris McNeil, the mother, this is towards the beginning of the movie, is at the movie set at Georgetown University, and she's walking home. She says, "Oh, I'll walk home," she says to the limo driver, and she's walking through the streets of Georgetown, and this is so subconscious, and I just love this, is when she's accosted by the trick-or-treaters. It's Halloween, and Halloween is the halfway point between the autumn equinox and the winter solstice. That's the official delineation mark of when darkness has overtaken the light, and the days the light is officially dead and darkness is exalted. So hence, you know, the demon spirit can come out. Light is in death. The sun is in death. The sun is in decay. The darkness and the demons come out. They, you know, attack the Dahlgren Chapel there on Georgetown University's campus and deface the Virgin Mary statue. And then they eventually come into the little girl. So I love the very subtle placement of Halloween in that movie to trigger the time of year in your subconscious mind that it's the death of light. It's the death of the sun. And hence darkness and demons are on the prowl, essentially. And then, of course, the little girl winds up getting possessed. So who do we call in? Well, we call in the two sun priests, the Jesuits. I mean, look no further than the seal of the Jesuits. There they are, the two, you know, Roman Catholic sun priests, essentially. A few years later, Stanley Kubrick employs this exact same trick in The Shining. And literally, it's the exact same thing. When Jack Torrance, Jack Nicholson, is interviewing with is at the very beginning of the movie, he's interviewing with Stuart Allman about getting the winter caretaker job. Allman says something to the effect of, and I'm just paraphrasing here. He says, "Well, where our hours of operation are around May 5th to October 30th. He said, and October 30th is our last business day. So it's, again, it's the same thing. So you know when the Torrance family, that scene when they arrive the next day to check into the Overlook and you see all the staff closing up and all the staffs leaving, that's Halloween. And it's the same thing that's going on. It's the same psychological subconscious effect. You know it's the death of the sun. You know it's the darkness is exalted. Hence all the ghosts and the demons and the, you know, vicious entities to come out to play in the Overlook Hotel and torment and terrorize quite literally the Torrance family. I mean, it's just great psychological subconscious imagery. It comes straight out of the collective unconscious, and these guys are just so masterful at playing with things like that. It's sublime. It's just, I mean, really, really a spectacle to watch.
It's amazing, too, because I think the way it affects the viewer on such an unconscious level, too, is just fascinating.
I totally agree. And again, this was part of my motivation, was to point this stuff out because I'm fascinated by it. And, you know, and sometimes this material gets, like I said at the opening of your show, sometimes this gets a bad rap. Oh, you know, this is, you know, mind control and this and that. I mean, if you take a step back from it, I think it can be actually quite beautiful. You know, this idea of just incorporating, I mean, it's very masterful. I mean, but this is real craftsmanship. You know, we're talking about here that, you know, that these guys are putting, you know, are thinking enough and putting this in, you know, and conveying to you these very deep esoteric themes. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's real artistry involved in this. So, Robert Sullivan, thank you once again. The book is Cinema Symbolism. Maybe you could just remind people where they can find your books and where they can find you online.
Yeah, well, thank you, Greg, for having me on Cult of Personality. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. If you're interested in what I've been talking about, the best way to find me is just my website. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. So my website is just my name. It's www.robertwsullivan, and it's the letter I, the letter V for the fourth, .com. There are links there to buy my books, Cinema Symbolism, and my first book, Royal Arch of Enoch. You can get them in paperback form. You can get them in the Amazon Kindle, all the ebooks. That's a lot cheaper. From my website, you can, you know, keep abreast of events and appearances and radio shows I'm doing. I have a YouTube channel, so you can check out other radio shows and TV shows and videos I've produced. You can also follow me on Twitter. There's links to my social media at my website. There's more information about me. It's all right there, links to buy the books. My website, again, www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
Robert Sullivan, thanks again. It's always great to speak with you.
My pleasure.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Robert Sullivan and I continue our conversation about esoteric symbolism in popular films, including more examples of hidden messages in films alluding to the space program, terrorism, and much, much more. Join us for that fascinating conversation. Just browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. Not only will you receive access to this great interview with Robert Sullivan, but you'll also get more than 100 others, all while supporting the podcast. Thanks again for listening, and until next time. We'll be right back.